National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, January 19th, and you've joined us for National Security This Week. We get together here on KYMN Radio every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security. We're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore American national security. So we have a great show for you today. Make sure you pour yourself an extra cup of coffee, call your family members, call your friends, and tell them to tune in. Quick recap, in October of 2001, only a few weeks after the events of 9/11, U.S. forces began operations in Afghanistan to capture or kill members of the designated terrorist group Al-Qaeda and to dislodge the reigning government at the time, the Taliban. With a relatively small footprint on the ground and with close air support, the U.S. military routed the Taliban and forced them and Al-Qaeda to flee into the mountains or cross Afghanistan's borders. For 20 years, the United States and our NATO allies supported the Afghan government, the Afghan military, and the people as they struggled to create a new nation. Sadly, it wasn't enough to erase the scourge of the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or even the Islamic State in the nation of Afghanistan. And all of us remember the events of August of 2021 and the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. We're always quick to place blame here in America, and I would submit to you that what we should always do first is to assess what went wrong, ensure we don't forget those important lessons, and then move forward, especially when it comes to American national security interests. Today, we have a very special guest on our show, someone who can tell us what was really happening in Afghanistan and leading up to the collapse of the Afghan government and military. He can help us to learn lessons from that conflict before we're drawn into a new, probably more deadly encounter elsewhere in the world. Our guest today is Ambassador Ross Wilson, who arrived in Kabul on January 18th of 2020 as the U.S. Chargé d'Affaires to the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. Over the course of four decades as a U.S. diplomat, Ambassador Wilson served as U.S. Ambassador to Azerbaijan from 2000 to 2003 and to Turkey from 2005 to 2008. And he held later assignments as Chargé d'Affaires in Turkey in 2014 and the Republic of Georgia from 2018 to 2019. Elsewhere overseas, Ambassador Wilson served at U.S. embassies in Moscow and Prague and was Consul General in Melbourne, Australia. He was Principal Deputy to the Ambassador at Large and Special Advisor to the U.S. Secretary of State for the new independent states of the former Soviet Union from 1997 to 2000. He also served as Deputy Executive Secretary of the U.S. State Department for Secretaries Jim Baker, Lawrence Eagleburger, and Warren Christopher, and as Chief of Staff to Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick, who was the Chief U.S. Negotiator for the Free Trade Area of the Americas. He also worked in the State Department offices dealing with the USSR and Egypt. From 2010 to 2014, Ambassador Wilson was Director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, where he led Atlantic Council work on Turkey, the former Soviet states, and regional energy, economic, and political issues and integration, and organized its annual Energy and Economic Summits in Istanbul. In addition, he has been a visiting lecturer in international affairs at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and served on the boards of Global Minnesota and the Institute of Turkish Studies, and on advisory councils of other nonprofit organizations active in international affairs. Ambassador Wilson received a bachelor's degree from the University of Minnesota and a master's degree from both Columbia University and the U.S. National War College. He's a recipient of the U.S. President's Meritorious Service Award, as well as numerous U.S. Department of State awards and honors. He holds memberships in the Academy of American Diplomacy, the American Foreign Service Association, Diplomatic and Consular Officers Retired, the Washington Institute of Foreign Affairs, and the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. Ambassador Wilson is married to Margot Squire, also a veteran of the U.S. Foreign Service, and they make their home in the Twin Cities. Ambassador Ross Wilson, thank you for joining us today. Welcome to National Security This Week.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
So, Ambassador, I often start the show by having a little discussion with my guests to learn a little more about their professional career background. You completed your undergraduate degree at the University of Minnesota. What was your major? And then what was your career path to join the Department of State?
Thanks, John, for the question. While I was at the U, I became very interested in history, political matters, took a couple of courses in diplomatic history, got interested in international relations, and especially the how international relations gets done. The place in the world or in life where an American can do international relations as opposed to write about it or talk about or observe it is in the U.S. Foreign Service. I pursued that career track. Went to Columbia to kind of hone my skills, so to speak. While I was there, I did an internship at the State Department. Successfully passed the Foreign Service Entrance Exam, which is the Foreign Service still uses a competitive exam to take in people, and was fortunate enough to be brought on board in the summer of 1979.
So your bio tells us that you had a very, very successful career at the Department of State as a diplomat. If you were going to give advice today to high school students or college students about who are interested in a career in diplomacy, what would that advice be?
Well, as I suggested in my first comments back to you, John, if for those who are interested in being in the game, in the mosh pit, in the doing of international affairs, in the conduct of America's foreign relations with other countries, a career in public service, and in particular a career in the U.S. Foreign Service, is the way to do that. Public service is a wonderful and tremendously rewarding thing. It's a way to make a difference in the world. A academic or other background in international affairs is not really essential. I know many Foreign Service officers who were English majors, physics majors, had degrees, law degrees, or other graduate degrees. Clearly, you have to have an interest in the world, in international issues, languages, foreign languages. Some experience abroad is very helpful. The entering age is not right out of college. The average entering age usually is in the late 20s, early 30s. There were people in my Foreign Service class in their mid-40s, and that's not particularly uncommon. I encourage those who are interested in being out in the world and representing the United States of America abroad to consider a career in the Foreign Service.
So language skills going in aren't necessarily required, but they are very helpful?
Language isn't required, but in the evaluation of candidates, and there are usually tens of thousands of candidates who are applying, in the evaluation of candidates, language skills and aptitude in foreign languages adds to the points you get, so to speak, and increases your odds to get in. That said, for most of our posts overseas, the State Department wants its officers abroad to have the local language, and so the Foreign Service Institute at the State Department will train people in whatever language is required for the country where they're serving. It might be Dari in the case of Afghanistan, or Thai in the case of Thailand, or Spanish, French, German when that's relevant. Obviously, the more exotic languages, there will be fewer people that come in having that aptitude.
Sure. Why don't we go ahead and start moving forward on our topic today of your time in Afghanistan. I'll ask this first. Your background indicates you had extensive experience in places like Turkey, Azerbaijan, and Georgia, among other nations. And you were actually called out of retirement and asked to take that leadership position in Kabul, Afghanistan. How do you decide whether or not to take that post, and what guidance did you receive before you went out to Kabul? And maybe briefly you could talk about the difference between being a U.S. ambassador and being a chargé, just so our audience understands the difference.
Sure. So in October of 2019, I got a call from a senior official at the State Department asking me if I would be willing to go out to Kabul to serve as chief of mission and chargé d'affaires of our embassy there. The incumbent ambassador was going to be leaving very shortly after the first of the year. The Trump administration was still deliberating on who to nominate as a permanent successor. And there's also, of course, the problem of getting people confirmed, or the time that it takes to get incoming people to confirmed. The leadership wanted, what I was told, they wanted somebody that had an ambassadorial title from a previous posting, both to give greater stature to our dealings with the Afghan government, helpful in our dealings and the embassy's dealings with the U.S. military, and the experience that an ambassador has running a large, complex mission, obviously very applicable in the largest and most complex mission that the United States had at that time. I agonized over this for my wife and I agonized over this for some time. It meant being separated, and that wasn't very interesting. I had never served in Afghanistan. There were lots of senior Foreign Service officers, including people with ambassadorial titles who had served there and struck me as better candidates. I went out to Washington, met with Secretary Pompeo, with Ambassador Khalilzad, with others to kind of talk through the issues and the approach to those issues before saying yes. Ultimately, I concluded it was my duty. I had signed up to the Foreign Service because in order to serve our country, I was being asked to do so, and I felt I had to do it. In the meetings that I had with Secretary Pompeo, with others, the guidance I think I had essentially was to help make the U.S.-Taliban agreement, if it came to fruition. This was in the fall of 2019, mm-hmm. to make, but if that agreement could be successfully concluded, to make it work and to ensure that it was well implemented. And specifically to support efforts to use the leverage that America's commitment that would be embodied in that agreement to withdraw, to use that leverage in order to secure a political settlement that preserved gains of the 20 years of the prior 20 years of our involvement in that country, and preserve our ability to advance American interests there. I was also asked to kind of look ahead to a post-settlement role for the United States, a post-settlement look of the American embassy, which was very large, extremely expensive, and sort of start to plan out that transition. Initially, my term in Kabul was to be 4 to 6 months. That got extended to the end of the year, and then extended to March, and then extended to the summer, and ultimately, of course, in the fall, when I left the country at the end of August.
Yeah, and we'll get to that. Well, it sounds to me that you received pretty clear guidance from Secretary Pompeo and the Trump administration about what was you were being asked to do. And we'll continue on with that discussion in a minute. For our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Ambassador Ross Wilson, who served as U.S. Chargé d'Affaires at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan. So, Ambassador, you arrive in Kabul on January 18th of 2020. What was the situation in Afghanistan at that time?
On a high plane, the country was relatively peaceful and stable, and had been for the preceding several months. As the U.S. Taliban agreement started to take shape in the summer and was almost signed and concluded in September, that had led to had produced a tremendous diminution in the level of attacks against U.S. and coalition forces in the country and against diplomatic establishments such as ours and the other allied partner countries in Kabul. It wasn't peaceful, mm-hmm. But it was a much lower tempo of violence, especially in Kabul and other big cities, than had been the case say 6 months or 12 months earlier. I was struck on arrival by the size of our mission and the seriousness with which everybody took security. I anticipated that, but it was still made a big impression. When I got off my airplane, I was asked to put on a flak jacket and a helmet, taken to an embassy facility at the airport, flown by helicopter to our diplomatic compound. People took that stuff very, very seriously, and I think especially so in the immediate wake. This was 2 weeks after Soleimani was taken out in Iran. There were a lot of fears of Iranian retaliation, and Afghanistan bordering on Iran had been seen at the time as a potential target. So everybody took security very, very seriously, and that made a big impression on me. Kabul was one of the largest, probably the largest mission, U.S. mission in the world, with a gigantic military overlay. I think 13,000 U.S. forces led by a four-star general. The embassy itself packed with a variety of U.S. government agencies, particularly the security agencies, but also AID, the FBI, Treasury, others, and with lots and lots of senior level attention in Washington, intense public interest in what was going on. The fact of my predecessor's departure, front page news in the New York Times, that obviously made an impression on me. There was clearly a yearning for peace. One could see that in the discussion. I saw that in the discussions that I had, initial discussions I had with Afghan leaders, Afghan civil society figures, political actors, and others. How that was going to happen, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty about that, a lot of fear about how that would work out, a lot of looking for reassurance as to what America's purposes were and how things would go forward.
Yeah. So you painted a great picture for us of sort of the interagency, the U.S. interagency coordination that was going on there in Afghanistan. Could you tell us a little bit about the daily coordination you did with, say, the Afghan government, the NATO leaders, ISAF as a whole, you know, that kind of thing? What were you working on a daily basis during that time frame up until the election and the transition from the Trump to Biden administration?
Well, as you suggested, John, you know, we had a large military, we had a large counterterrorism operation, we had many agencies, we had lots of money, lots and lots of people. I think the embassy was around 4,000 staff when I arrived, plus the 12,000 plus U.S. soldiers, plus another other baskets of people. Each one of the seniors in these constellations met with President Ghani, met with other senior political leaders and government senior ministers. No one in Washington really sees across the spectrum of U.S. relations with any country, other than the ambassador and the senior most people at post. That's typical of any of all of the missions in which I have served. And that's part of the ambassador's job is to see across everything and to try to make sure that the various arms of the U.S. government that are involved are coordinated and reasonably in sync. That was really, really, really big business in Afghanistan. I met with the president roughly once a week for the 20 months that I was there. Some weeks it was more frequent. There were some breaks, especially face-to-face breaks during COVID when we had to do it virtually via Zoom or by phone or by some other platform. I tried to meet or talk with General Miller, the commander of Resolute Support mission, the NATO mission, and also the commander of U.S. forces there, with the other senior people, to talk through what we were hearing from Afghan leaders, and what we were saying to Afghan leaders, in part to ensure that we were saying, if not exactly the same thing, at least complementary things, and that there was never any suggestion that the Afghans could play us off one another or make use of different things that they were hearing from us. Our role on the peace process was somewhat limited. We I had absolutely no dealings with the Taliban. That was Ambassador Khalilzad's role. Our job was to support him and to support what he was doing with the Talibs and to support his discussions with the Afghan government, in which, of course, I was very involved. But this was a big and complex set of things going on, and then of course it also involved thousands of people working for me, the challenges of COVID, the challenges of morale at this diplomatic outpost, very, very isolated from Afghan society. And that kind of the challenges that represents, that also was a big part of what I and others in the leadership team had to deal with.
Okay. So a year roughly after you arrived, the U.S. has a transition of government between President Trump and President Biden. And normally I know that U.S. ambassadors tender their resignations when the new administration comes in, but you were asked to remain in Kabul. What was the specific ask from the Biden administration, and what new guidance did you receive from the incoming Biden team about your duties and their plans for Afghanistan?
So, as you noted, ambassadors usually are asked to submit their resignations. I wasn't a presidentially appointed, Senate-confirmed ambassador, so no such request came to me. In fact, in the discussions that I had with the transition team, and then obviously, especially and officially after people came into office on January 21st, I was asked, would I be willing to stay until they could kind of get their house in order and decide on a longer term path for the embassy in Afghanistan and for U.S.-Afghan relations generally.
And if I could clarify something very quickly, that's pretty normal that a chief of mission holds down the fort until the new ambassadors can be appointed and confirmed, right? Nominated and confirmed.
Yes, usually career ambassadors are also asked to submit their resignation at the time of administration's change, but career ambassadors almost always remain in place until a new career appointee comes out. Mm-hmm. In the case of presidential appointees, the when they leave, the role of acting chief of mission then falls to the number two, who is chargé d'affaires in the same way that I was, or in a similar way to the role that I played. In my case, it was a little bit more indefinite, more or less right from the start, and in a higher stakes situation.
So the guidance you get from the Biden administration was continue on what you're doing, or did they give you some guidance, new things they wanted you to work on?
I think broadly speaking, yes, it was to continue to work on the things along the same lines of emphasis that I had been given by Secretary Pompeo. They conveyed to me and to Afghan leaders their intent that the United States would continue strongly to support Afghanistan, would continue security and economic assistance there, continue to support meaningful and sincere negotiations that were in Doha, the Afghan Taliban negotiations in Doha that had begun in the previous September 2020. And carry out our activities in a way to try to preserve gains that the country had made, gains in terms of the rights of women, the rights of minorities, the democratic institutions that had developed there, the freedoms and the prosperity, such as it was, that had developed. We wanted to try to maintain and continue to build on that. The incoming administration set about, and again, this was conveyed to me, I was part of this process, set about a review of the terms of the U.S.-Taliban agreement so that they understood more clearly than they would have as private citizens prior to January 21st, what were the terms of the agreement and the extent to which it was being implemented and honored by the Taliban, to a comprehensive review of U.S.-Afghan relations and, you know, what was going on actually, behind news headlines, and to talk through the range of issues relating to the specific commitment in the U.S.-Taliban agreement that U.S. and coalition forces would be gone out of the country by May 1st. And the discussions that I was most directly involved in had really to do with two sets of issues, one or maybe three sets of issues. One was these matters having to do with the withdrawal and the consequences of a withdrawal of American forces should the president decide, President Biden decide to go ahead with that. And second, how to ameliorate those consequences, especially the negative consequences, potential negative consequences in terms of our counterterrorism priorities, in terms of our cooperation and support of the Afghan government and Afghan security forces, in terms of our Afghan friends and partners, both those who had worked directly for the U.S. government in the past, but others whom we had supported and helped, and who had supported and helped us and advance our objectives in the country. I think the Afghan side was very, very anxious to engage with the new administration. In fact, senior leaders wanted to go to Washington more or less on January 21st to engage with the new team. They were dissuaded from that in part because of COVID and kind of a clampdown on face-to-face meetings that had been in existence for some time, of course, the stack up of urgent tasks that the new administration had. They got in Washington also got kind of a steady stream of engagements, conversations, phone calls, video conferences and the like over the months that followed. And my role really was to be on point between the periodic phone calls and both try to explain to President Ghani where things were, what was happening, what issues were on the table, but also to convey his views and the views of other senior leaders as Washington tried to sort through an extremely difficult and challenging set of decisions, whether to withdraw U.S. forces on May 1st, under what terms, and then how to deal with some of the potential implications of that for the Afghan government, for our friends and partners, and for the embassy's ability safely to continue to function.
So the Trump administration's negotiations with the Taliban, the agreement was that we were going to be out May 1st. Is that right?
That was the date that's provided for in the U.S.-Taliban agreement that was signed in February 2020.
And typically when we're talking about international relations, we want consistency from one administration to the next in all foreign affairs agreements. Is that roughly accurate? Or we try to?
That's a good international practice. I think that was the priority or maybe not the default, but that was a big part of what I perceived, a big part of the way that the Biden administration looked at this. Mm-hmm. They did not want to just walk away from this, certainly not walk away from the May 1st undertaking, and certainly not to do so without having very carefully thought through the potential implications for security in Afghanistan, yeah. The implications for the peace talks that were underway, the implications with our allies and partners in that country, the implications in terms of how foreigners look at agreements that they conclude with the United States in general, and the durability of commitments that aren't enshrined in a treaty. Again, continuity in foreign affairs is in general a good thing, or certainly something that you want to consider as you look at your foreign policy priorities going forward.
Okay, can we talk a little bit about Afghanistan's president at the time, Ashraf Ghani. What was he like as a leader, as a person? Did you get a sense of the man's hopes for his nation when you had these weekly dialogues with him?
I'd had the good fortune to have met President Ghani before he became president. While I was at the Atlantic Council, he was involved in a number of our programs there, and I was struck by his he's a very serious scholar. He burrows deep, really drills down into the details of issues and wants to know and to understand them, and draws conclusions. The flip side of that is, he's a man who believes he knows more than others and often does, but certainly believes that he knows more than others and has a better understanding than others. He saw himself as the leader of the post 9/11 Afghanistan, and of the generation that came of age and came into power and into influence, and wanted to right up to the very end. Wanted to preserve and to protect that, and not see the country slide back. Ghani had spent a lot of time in the United States. He came here on a scholarship, went to either high school or the first few years of college. Saw himself as a modernizer. I think the liability and this the flip side of thinking you know more than others do. His modernization was top down. He was not interested in the politics of building support for strategies. Rather, he would figure it out. He would figure out the right strategy, and that's what would happen. That had the effect of alienating others. In the Afghan political firmament and undermining the objectives that he was trying to pursue.
So not a big coalition builder, in other words.
No.
How about leadership of, his relationship with the leadership of the military, the national police? Did he have good working relations with them, or was he sort of alienating them in the process as well?
The actions that he took in the time that I was there, and developments on the ground, I think, undermined his relations with the military. Mm. He was seen again as he saw himself as somebody who understood security problems better than they did, better than security leaders did. He was seen as a micromanager. He was regarded by many in the military as someone who bullied his senior commanders. He frequently changed them, often in a case where things go wrong in military security affairs. You lose battles, or your positions become compromised and you have to withdraw. And sometimes the result of that is you change commanders, particularly if you've got somebody else in line who will do better. But if you don't, then maybe you think twice or three or four times about making changes. He was quick to make changes. He was quick to criticize. And one of the phenomena that we dealt with in 2021 in particular, and that became worse and worse and worse as we got into the summer and headed toward the collapse on August 15th, was a churn in senior military and security sector commanders. Churn in ministerial appointments in the security field, and a great deal of micromanagement by President Ghani and by his senior people in security affairs on which they lacked expertise and experience.
How about I know that Afghanistan has always been this sort of unique place where you have all these provincial kind of warlords, or in this case, governors. What kind of relationship did he have with the provincial governors? Was it a good one with some, bad with others, notoriously bad across the board? I mean, what was it that you observed?
Sure. Well, I'll separate two different categories there. The president appoints all the governors.
Okay.
So he had a fine relationship with them. and when things went wrong, he'd fire them. And there was a certain amount of churn in the governors as well. And that increased throughout the time that I was there, especially in the last 6 months or so. The regional power brokers, for the most part, were not governors and never had been. These are people like Dostum, like Mohakek and Khalilig, the leaders of the Hazara, of Hazara militias and militia and political groups, a couple of different Tajik leaders. And Ghani's relationships with them were not good. Occasionally, he would strike deals with them. He struck a deal in 2014 to include Dostum on the presidential ticket as one of his two vice presidents, and in a deal, a political marriage of convenience that served President Ghani's needs and presumably also those of Dostum for a period. But in general, Ghani's relationships with the warlords were bad, and part of that was that this top down, I know better, lack of coalition building politics or lack of political sense. But there was also a conviction on Ghani's part that the warlords were that was Afghanistan's past, that Afghanistan had to move away from that. Toward in the direction of stable institutions that could rise above warlordism and factional militia driven politics. It wasn't necessarily the wrong idea,
right?
But how it got pursued and implemented presented a lot of problems for Afghanistan and for the United States there.
Cultural changes are a hard thing to institute. So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Ambassador Ross Wilson, who served as U.S. Charge d'Affaires in the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan. Ambassador, I'm going to ask sort of a two-part question. I'll preempt it by just saying this. Throughout the late winter and spring of 2021 back here in the U.S., we kept hearing about the news about these tens of thousands of Afghans who'd applied for special immigrant visa, or the SIV, as they kept referring to it in the news. Very quickly, who were the SIV applicants? Can you give us a quick rundown on that?
Sure. So under the terms of what's called the Allies Afghan Protection Act of 2009, Afghan citizens who had worked for or with the United States government were allowed or entitled to apply for immigrant visas to the United States. Normally, when you apply for an immigrant visa, you have to have a relative here or some kind of a tie. The tie in the case of Afghans was having worked for us. You didn't have to have a brother or a parent or some other direct relative that you were traveling to the United States to be with. So these were interpreters, these were fixers, these were people in staff positions for the U.S. military, for the contractors that supported the U.S. military at our embassy in Kabul, and working in other ways for the U.S. government. Over time, that kind of got modified a little bit beyond direct hire, people in direct hire positions for the U.S. government to include contractors, subcontractors. That came along a little bit later. What's special about a special immigrant visa are two things. One is you get to apply for an immigrant visa without the family ties that would otherwise have to be part of the deal. But you also move to the head of the queue in terms of processing. Once you have demonstrated your eligibility for that special piece, for that special treatment. And under the terms of the law and the way it was implemented from 2009 on, applicants had to produce a letter of recommendation from their supervisor, American supervisor, and then a documentation, separate documentation to support the assertion that they had in fact worked for the U.S. government, documentation from an HR department, for example, and then a range of other Afghan focused documents, a passport, and ID cards and the like, and they had to sign an affirmation that they believed that they faced imminent threat or feared imminent threat in Afghanistan, it wasn't just that they wanted to go, but that they faced threats. When I arrived in Afghanistan, the backlog of SIV applicants was something in the order of 18,000. But to understand that figure, one piece to note is that there seemed to be a substantial body of applicants who applied, took the initial step of going onto the website and filling out the initial forms, their name and that sort of thing, and then they get this list of documents that they need to obtain, but then subsequently seem not to have pursued the application. Perhaps they realized on looking at the details that they weren't going to qualify. Mm. Maybe they couldn't track down an American supervisor. Maybe too many years had passed, or they didn't know how to access through the internet or by other means to try to track people down. Maybe they couldn't get HR letters affirming or describing their service to the U.S. government. But there were also some very significant bottlenecks in the program. In order to be approved for special immigrant visa, the approval was by the chief of mission in Kabul, but it followed a set of bureaucratic and security checks by an office in Washington, not in Kabul. That was always understaffed, and was not a priority, more or less from the time it was established, and in particular was understaffed and sidelined, in the several years before we left Afghanistan and before the Biden administration came in. And then there was also this little problem of COVID,
right,
that closed our consular section to normal public access from about April, maybe mid late April 2020 until January 2021. We weren't processing SIV applicants. We were receiving applications, and there was some backlog of people who had been approved, and so we were able to issue some documentation to those who had gotten through the program, but an important part of the checking of people's bona fides. Afghanistan is a deeply, deeply corrupt country,
yeah, right.
And lots of applications for jobs at the embassy, for SIVs, for all kinds of things that lacked substantiation, shall we say. So an important part of the SIV process, crucial actually, or deemed crucial, was a face-to-face interview with a consular officer,
okay,
who could ask questions and try to ascertain the bona fides of the person, the family sitting in front of him. This is the family that's described in these documents. This is the person that worked for the U.S. government. That individual can answer some questions about what they did for us, and you know, the story sort of fits. And those in-person interviews also, as I suggested, got kind of constipated, shall we say, from April to January. After that, we embarked on a big push to try to accelerate the processing. I think it's on the order of 4,000 or 5,000 that we were able to move through the pipeline before the government fell and we had to leave. And at the end of that, the number I believe was around 21,000 or 22,000.
Okay,
many Afghans who had worked for the U.S. government in previous years, many who were working at that time either for the U.S. military or at the embassy, who hadn't, frankly speaking, hadn't bothered to apply. They had not applied for an SIV as they looked at the political and security situation around them. Applied for the program, and the numbers, kind of went back up.
Okay. There are three more questions that I'd like to ask you. We're starting to run short on time, so I'll ask you if you could sort of be direct with me on these answers. The Taliban began advancing across Afghanistan really in the early summer, and it's pretty clear from the news reports that they were well-armed and well-financed. Without giving away any classified information, obviously, how was it that the Taliban were able to acquire all that equipment? What nation or nations were backing them as they started their offensive to retake Afghanistan? Were they being provided intelligence support by any other nations? I mean, what were you hearing on the ground?
Well, it seemed evident that the Taliban got a significant amount of support from Pakistan. They certainly had sanctuary in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. The extent to which the Pakistanis provided military equipment, intelligence support, I can't really provide much specifics there. But there was a level of support, and that kind of goes without saying. In addition, though, the Talibs raised money on their own. They ran and supported a lucrative drug trafficking business. They collected taxes from citizens in the 50% or so, 50-60% of the country that they occupied, that their forces occupied. They collected taxes on shipments that went through territory that they controlled. So trucks bringing cargo to Kabul, moving stuff around the country. Very often, usually, in fact, went through Taliban checkpoints, and those truckers had to pay fees. They were able to use monies, and this is billions of dollars that they were able to raise themselves to procure weaponry on the international black market. There's a lot of stuff out there. They weren't the most sophisticated force. They didn't have expensive tanks. They had no air force. They had Toyota trucks, they had machine guns, they had small and simple rockets. Those aren't terribly expensive, and I think they're not that difficult to procure.
Yeah. As the Taliban took provincial capital after capital, what was the sense of the Afghan government in Kabul about their chances of remaining in power? I mean, more precisely, at what point did you realize that the senior political leaders, military leaders, even the national police leaders in Afghanistan were going to throw in the towel and run away bravely? And how did that sequence unfold as you witnessed it?
Well, there's a long answer to that, John, but maybe the short one. In the summer, in June, in the first part of July, I think we became increasingly concerned about Taliban advances and a significant expansion of the areas that the Taliban controlled, increasingly effective attacks. Around provincial capitals, although not until late July on provincial capitals, but high level of vulnerability, increasing limits on our ability to support them as U.S. forces have drawn down, our ability to carry out local airstrikes or carry out other activity to support them is diminishing quite substantially. The pivot point, I think, clearly was in early August. Okay. The first provincial capital fell, I think, on August 7 or 8 the capital of Helmand. A whole bunch fell in rapid succession, in particular the capitals in the north that cut off Afghanistan from its principal source and our embassy's principal source of fuel and electricity, which was the Central Asian states, and at that point the situation starts to look really very, very tenuous.
Yeah. So, Ambassador Wilson, I know the events of the evacuation are still pretty fresh in your mind. As we say in the military, a significant emotional experience. And you went through that entire evacuation operation. I want to give you a chance to kind of share your thoughts on the evacuation, the horrific choices you and other leaders had to make kind of in real time. Is there anything you'd like to share about that evacuation operation?
Sure. The situation at the airport, especially at the outset, was highly chaotic. Even just the simple matter of gaining control of the airfield. I'm sure you and your listeners recall those images of crowds streaming across the tarmac that raised a lot of questions about whether we were going to be able to do evacuations. Yeah. and frankly, about our ability safely to remain there. The situation outside the perimeter of the airport, one of my colleagues used the term, said it's like a scene out of Lord of the Flies. Hmm. Ghastly, frightening crowds, terrified people, Talib soldiers who aren't trained in this. They're dealing with a situation that they had in no way anticipated. And then you have what one can liken to a kind of a Niagara Falls of appeals to us for help from Afghan friends and partners that we had, from Afghan institutions that were important to us, from Western media organizations, Western businesses, Western political leaders who were concerned about people that they were. That had supported them. Exhaustion, you know, all of us at the embassy who were evacuated, the embassy, which at that point was about 1,500 people, evacuated the airport, but all but maybe 25 or so flew out of the country more or less immediately. Those that remained behind, exhausted by days and days before we went to the airport of, you know, 20 hours a day of work. But and then that compounds itself in this ghastly situation in which we found itself. A huge amount of sadness about what was happening around us, a lot of fear, well-founded fear of ISIS attacks, uncertainty about the Taliban's intentions around the airport, intense scrutiny from Washington. On what we were doing. A lot of very, very helpful involvement by seniors to solve problems and solve bottlenecks where they existed. And that was helpful to us. Also, use the term in the military, the 10,000 mile screwdriver,
right.
Two things that really in a way that didn't work from afar. The hardest thing I ever did. Mm.
I started our show today with a missive that we should focus less on blame in America when it comes to national security interests, because those are really, you know, kind of are nonpartisan, really, in many words, and more on learning the lessons from our failures so don't repeat them. And frankly, our 20 years of effort in Afghanistan, I don't think we can say anything other than we failed. So for you, as a career senior diplomat with experience all over the world, what do you think are the most important lessons America should learn from our experience in Afghanistan?
I'd say a couple of things, John. First, I'm I'm not sure I agree entirely with the proposition that we failed.
Okay.
We did not entirely succeed. We did, in some very fundamental and important ways, transform Afghanistan and Afghan society for the better.
Yeah.
In terms of life expectancy, opportunities for people, the opening up of that country and drawing it into the rest of the world. A whole generation came of age while we were there, more embedded in Western values and in global values than had ever been the case before. Mm-hmm. Most of those people are still there. That investment is still there. And I think that investment will continue to play an important influencing role in Afghanistan and in the future. And I say that in part because we don't want to sell ourselves too short. We didn't entirely fail there. And we did some important things. Mm-hmm. I think a second point is, you know, we we also need, I believe, to find ways to continue to be involved there. We made a mistake in Afghanistan in the 1990s in leaving and especially in staying gone for all of those years from the collapse of the communist regime or before the collapse of the communist regime through to 2001. That wasn't good. It wasn't good for our interests and it wasn't good for Afghanistan. And so I am a proponent of our finding ways to get back in there, get back in the game, exercise the influence that we have, help to stem this frightening humanitarian catastrophe that's unfolding there as a result of drought as well as war and the breakdown of state institutions. And find ways through the manner in which we deal with the government. We don't like the government. There are lots of governments we don't like. Find ways in which we deal with that government and with society to advance our interests, whether it's security or humanitarian or otherwise. I think some strategic patience is required there. It certainly isn't easy. And won't be easy, but that would be my prescription for going forward.
Yeah, I was on a panel not long after we'd finished the withdrawal out of Afghanistan over at Carleton College, and I actually made the point that history is continuously being made, so we really don't know what the outcome is going to be yet in Afghanistan, and your discussion about the investment that we made over that 20 years, that entire generation of kids that grew up under freedom and opportunity, that may have some long-lasting impacts on what's going to happen there. And you mentioned the U.S. should remain engaged, and we made a mistake about not being engaged. I don't know if you've ever heard of the book by Steve Cole called Ghost Wars. For our listeners, that is a fascinating book. It's a must-read if you really want to understand what was happening in Afghanistan from the start of the Soviet invasion up until September 10th of 2001. We've come to the end of today's edition of National Security This Week. Ambassador Ross Wilson, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a fantastic discussion. I'm really pleased that you were able to join us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
What are you pursuing now that you're kind of retired again? Anything interesting?
I'm trying to get back into normal life and taking care of things at home that kind of got unattended for nearly 2 years.
Okay. Well, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for being a loyal listener of National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.
The days are getting cooler, and it means it's time to take a trip to Witt Brothers for your winter checkup. Let's face it, no one wants to get caught in the cold with a dead battery. Make sure your vehicle is in peak condition for the winter season. The checkup includes an oil change, tire rotation, brake inspection, battery tests, and they'll even winterize your vehicle. Stop by Witt Brothers Service, located at 701 Division Street in downtown.